Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, second canto, chapter 6, Purusha Sukta, confirm, text 36. Natosmyaham tacharanam samiyusham. Bhavachchiram swasayanam sumangalam. Yohatma maya vibhavam smapaya God. Yatana baswantam atapare kuta. Nata, let me offer my obeisances. Asmi, am. Aham, I. Tat, the Lord's. Charanam, feet. Samiyusham, of the surrendered soul. Bhavat chidam, that which stops repetition of birth and death. Swasti ayanam, perception of all happiness. Sumangalam, all auspicious. Ya, one who. He, exactly. Atma maya, personal energies. Vibhavam, potency. Sma, certainly. Paryagat, cannot estimate. Yata, as much as. Nabha, the sky. Swaandam, its own limit. Ata, therefore. Appare, others. Kuta, how? Translation. Brahma is speaking to Narada Muni. Therefore, it is best for me to surrender unto his feet, which alone can deliver one from the miseries of repeated birth and death. Such surrender is all auspicious and allows one to perceive all happiness. Even the sky cannot estimate the limits of its own expansion. So what can others do when the Lord himself is unable to estimate his own limits? Purport. Lord Brahma, the greatest of all learned living beings, the greatest sacrificer, the greatest observer of the austere life, and the greatest self-realized mystic, advises us as a supreme spiritual master of all living beings that one should simply surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord in order to achieve all success, even up to the limit of being liberated from the miseries of material life and being endowed with all auspicious spiritual existence. Lord Brahma is known as the Pitamaha, or the Father's Father. A young man consults his experienced father about discharging his duties, so the father is naturally a good advisor. But Lord Brahma is the father of all fathers. He is the father of Manu, who is the father of mankind all over the universal planets. Therefore, the men of this insignificant planet should kindly accept the instruction of Brahmaji and would do well to surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord rather than try to estimate the length and breadth of the Lord's potencies. His potencies are immeasurable, as confirmed in the Vedas, Parasya Shaktir Vividaiva Shruyate Svabhavaki Gana Balakriya Cha Svetasvatara Upanishad. He is the greatest of all, and all others, even the greatest of all living beings, namely Brahmaji, admits that the best thing for us is to surrender unto him. Therefore, only Those persons with a very poor fund of knowledge claim that they themselves are the lords of all that they can survey. And what can they survey? They cannot survey even the length and breadth of a small sky in one small universe. The so-called material scientist says that he would need to live 40,000 years to reach the highest planet of the universe, being carried by a Sputnik. This is also utopian, because no one can be expected to live 40,000 years. Besides, when the space pilot returned from his travel, none of his friends would be present to receive him back as the greatest astronaut, as has become fashionable for modern bewildered scientific men. One scientific man, who has no belief in God, was very much enthusiastic in making plans for his material existence and therefore opened a hospital to save the living. But after opening the hospital, he himself died within 6 months. So one should not spoil his human life, which is obtained after many, many changes of bodies in 8,400,000 species of life, simply for the concocted material happiness of life through increasing artificial needs in the name of advancement of economic development and scientific knowledge. Rather, one should simply surrender unto the feet of the Lord to make a solution to all miseries of life. That is the instruction of Lord Krishna directly in the Bhagavad Gita, and that is the instruction of Srimad Bhagavatam by Brahmaji, the Supreme Father of all living beings. Anyone denying this surrendering process, as recommended both in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and, for that matter, in all authorized scriptures, will be forced to surrender unto the laws of material nature. The living entity, by his constitutional position, is not independent. He must surrender either unto the Lord or unto material nature. Material nature is also not independent of the Lord, since the Lord himself has claimed material nature as mama maya, or my energy, and as me bina prakriti ashtada, or my separated energy in 8 divisions. Therefore, material nature is also controlled by the Lord, as he has claimed in Bhagavad Gita, maya dhyakshena prakriti suyate characharam. Under my direction only is material nature working, and thus are all things moving. And the living entities, being superior energy to matter, have choice and discrimination, either to surrender unto the Lord or to surrender unto material nature. By surrendering unto the Lord, one is happy and liberated. But by surrendering unto material nature, the living entity suffers. So the end of all suffering means surrendering unto the Lord, because the surrendering process itself is bhava-chitam, liberation from all material miseries, swasthyanam, perception of all happiness, and sumangalam, the source of everything auspicious. Therefore, liberty, happiness, and all good fortune can be attained only by surrendering unto the Lord, because he is full liberty, full happiness, and full auspiciousness. Such liberation and happiness are also unlimited, and they have been compared to the sky. Although such liberation and happiness are infinitely greater than the sky, in our present position, we can simply understand the magnitude of greatness when it is compared to the sky. We fail to measure the sky, but the happiness and liberty obtained in association with the Lord are far greater than the sky. That spiritual happiness is so great that it cannot be measured, even by the Lord himself, not to speak of others. It is said in the scriptures, Brahma Sokyam Tanandam, spiritual happiness is unlimited. Here it is said that even the Lord cannot measure such happiness. This does not mean the Lord cannot measure it and is therefore imperfect in that sense. The actual position is that the Lord can measure it, but the happiness in the Lord is also identical with the Lord on account of absolute knowledge. So the happiness derived from the Lord may be measured by the Lord, But the happiness increases again, and the Lord measures it again, and then again the happiness increases more and more, and the Lord measures it more and more, and as such there is eternally a competition between increment and measurement, so much so that the competition is never stopped, but goes on unlimitedly ad infinitum. Spiritual happiness is anandam buddhibhardhanam, or the ocean of happiness which increases. The material ocean is stagnant, but the spiritual ocean is dynamic. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila 4th chapter, Kaviraj Goswami has very nicely described this dynamic increment of the ocean of spiritual happiness in the transcendental person of Srimati Radharani, the pleasure potency of Lord Krishna. Om Gana Chimadandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militangena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. Lord Brahma is speaking to Narada Muni. You are getting a seat amidst the conversation of two inconceivable personalities. And they are talking about someone even more inconceivable. They are talking about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Srimad Bhagavatam is giving you direct access to the highest dialogues in the universe, the deepest knowledge, the greatest technology in all of existence. A few verses ago, you heard Brahma describe why the information coming from him is so important, and indeed, it is infallible. Why is that? You might say, well, Lord Brahma is a person, there are so many demigods, there are so many human beings. Isn't everyone entitled to their opinion? Indeed, isn't everyone entitled to their own truth? But Brahma, in his autobiographical presentation, is letting you know that there's something special about him, even beyond his material power and intellect, his position as the Adi Kavi, the original learned person in the universe. This something beyond that even. So when you think of Brahma and his authoritativeness, first you think of his material situation. As the preeminent living being in the universe. But then you think of his spiritual situation. And that's what he described a few verses ago to his son Narada. O Narada, because I have caught hold of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, with great zeal, whatever I say has never been proved to have been false. Nor is the progress of my mind ever deterred, nor are my senses ever degraded by temporary attachment to matter. So Brahma is saying, all these qualifications that I have, which make the information I'm giving impeccable and infallible. All these qualifications are because of my connection to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because I'm, so to speak, holding on tight. The very term yoga means connection, means link. So Brahma is demonstrating the results at the pinnacle of the yoga system. He's describing himself to Narada Muni as a yogi. He's letting you know, I am skillful in the full yoga system, meaning how to use my mind and senses for the ultimate realization. Because Brahmaji has successfully connected with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, therefore the knowledge coming from him is so valuable and can be trusted. Otherwise, you think Well, Brahma says this, that one says that. I also think. I have an opinion. It's a democracy. Not simply one person, one vote, but one person, one opinion. Why not? One person, five opinions. Or one person, no opinion. That's considered a glorious position these days. I have no opinion. Oh, you're very wise. Very good. You should have no opinions, no judgments, no discriminations. Just accept everything. Very good, very good. We need more people like you. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, this is my opinion. Of course, when you understand who is Krishna, then you accept his opinion. Everything is ultimately subjective in that the ultimate reality is the Supreme Person. That means the subjective opinion of Krishna is reality. But you are so tiny. What is the value of your subjective opinion? But that is what's happening in Kali Yuga. I'm a person. I don't know for how long I'll be a person. I don't even know what it means to be a person. I don't know what is consciousness. I don't know how consciousness arose in me. But I have an opinion. And you have an opinion. So together, let's try to make a truce between all the different opinions. We all have a right to live according to our own view, as long as it doesn't hurt somebody else, as far as we notice. So, in that way, we are glorifying our own subjectivity. If you want to be more graphic, you could say that like pigs wallow in the mud, we wallow in our own subjectivity, being very proud of our vision, our perception. The contemporary way, for example, to raise children is never interfere with your children's opinions. Let them think and do whatever they like as long as there's a hope that they can be happy. That's the cutting edge of raising children. Whatever makes you happy, dear, follow your dream, do whatever you like, as long as you think it's going to bring you happiness. Your father and I, or your second stepfather and I, or we are supporting you. Whatever. Actually, now that I remember, yes, I'm not your biological mother, but that's all right. I happen to be the third wife that your husband married. He did marry, you know, unlike many people these days. At least he married three times. So, subjectivity is worship so much. You have a right to your opinion. No one should trample your opinions. When you read Srimad Bhagavatam, you're also getting opinions, but opinions and perceptions, as we said, by persons of the highest caliber. And Brahma is describing his perfection in giving knowledge as being dependent on his connection with Bhagavan. Because of that, he said, therefore you can listen to me. Otherwise, even in Vedic culture, there can be arguments. Who should you listen to? This demigod says this, that demigod says that. So why are we especially sitting and hearing from Brahma? He describes that due to his connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his words, his senses, his actions are infallible. Because the Acharyas explain, Brahma is saying that because he's captured in his mind the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, by virtue of that connection, not him himself considered alone, but by virtue of the connection, everything is working out in a way that everyone can depend on what Brahma is saying. So therefore, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada writes that anyone, therefore, who is earnestly serious in heart and soul about being in intimate touch with the personality of Godhead in the relationship of transcendental loving service will always be infallible in words and action. The reason is that the Supreme Lord is absolute truth, and anything earnestly dovetailed with the absolute truth attains the same transcendental quality. So this is what we are aiming for. How to be so connected to Krishna that we become like the iron rod put into the fire. The iron rod acts like fire because of its connection to the fire. By our connection to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and of course that connection comes through parampara, otherwise it doesn't happen. By that connection, our whole life becomes 100% spiritualized. Indeed, we become reliable and trustworthy. So this is another point that Brahma is indirectly making in his talks to Narada Muni. He's saying, how can you actually trust someone who is insecure or even ignorant of their relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead? How can you trust their mind? How can you trust their words? How can you trust their actions? Yet when you look at the mundane world, you see countless personalities trying to present themselves as reliable and trustworthy. People commonly say you can't trust politicians. They just say whatever they need to say to get reelected. But yet those same persons will trust so many other kinds of mundane persons. They'll try to trust. They'll try to depend on others. And the whole history of material life is how many times you're let down, frustrated, exploited, as you try to depend on others and trust others. Regarding getting knowledge and correct information, or trusting them in relationships, so many traumas are incurred lifetime after lifetime, because we're dependent on persons who are not worthy of being dependent upon. So Brahma is saying, I'm also dependent. Even though I'm the great Brahma, the Adi Kavi, still I'm dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But because of that particular dependency, which he's recommending to everyone, therefore his words are completely trustworthy and valuable. So this is a very important point. The goal of our spiritual practice is to be so connected with the Supreme Personality of Godhead that we overcome our sense of amputation, functioning as an amputated limb. We overcome our sense of limitation as separate from Krishna. We are always limited, but in proper connection with Krishna, we have access to whatever Krishna wants to grant us. And this is what Brahma is saying. Even he is the greatest meditator, the most austere person. Yet, what is the value without a connection to the Supreme Personality of Godhead? And because of Brahma's connection, everything can proceed properly. And he can benefit others. This is an important point for us. How can you actually depend on someone who has no connection or a very shaky connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead? But we want to depend. That's the nature of the living entity, to want to depend on someone for relationships. And you want to depend on others for getting accurate information. Information is considered to be so crucial today. Are you getting the right information? Are you storing and categorizing that information properly? The one who has the most information and can access that information quickest, that's the one who will be on top. So many of you, the IT wallahs, that's what you're all involved with. do we ever consider what is the use of information from unreliable persons? That is the story of Kali Yuga. You can't depend on anyone for proper information. Even your own family members, your beloved parents, your beloved spouse, unless they're connected to Krishna, how can you depend on them for an accurate vision, an accurate perception? And because of that lack of correct vision and perception, generation after generation of children slaughter themselves pursuing material goals. Or else they succumb to another mythology that when you're young, that is in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, that is the time for economic expansion. And when you're in your, well, not even 60s, 70s, that's the time for spiritual knowledge. So this mythology is spoiling generation after generation. And that mythology is because of hearing from improper authorities, even though those authorities may be our near and dear family members, spouses, so on. So Brahma is making a challenge. He's saying, evaluate everyone, especially evaluate those from whom you take information. Evaluate them in terms of their connection to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Brahma's information is foremost because he says, I keep the Supreme Personality of Godhead always within my mind. With enthusiasm, with great earnestness, with great energy, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is always in my mind. Therefore, Narada, you can listen to me. In other words, it's not simply I'm your father that you should listen to me. No, look at my connection. Look whom I'm connected to. In the mundane world, people want social connections that will help them in work, that help them in making their way through the material world. A person who has lots of connections is considered very successful. So Brahma is telling you that he has the ultimate connection. Therefore, you can listen to him. A practical example is given by Srila Prabhupada that traditionally and ordinarily speaking, in a normal family, persons will accept the authority of the father. Father means well. And that father knows something about life. You think like that unless you're a Western teenager, then you know your father doesn't know anything. But even today in India, the sons, the daughters, they try to accept the wisdom of the father. So therefore, Prabhupada said, if that's the case in a normal, traditional material family, why not accept Brahma, who is the father of the father of the fathers? And then what does Brahma say? He says, although I'm Pitamaha, I'm the greatest father of all the succeeding fathers, I accept the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the ultimate cause. So in this way, from so many different angles, the Bhagavatam is coming at you to persuade you to give up your rebellion against Krishna. And today, we're hearing Brahma making his conclusion to you. And he's expressing that conclusion in terms of himself, but obviously it's meant for everyone. He says, therefore, it is best for me to surrender unto his feet. Therefore, Brahma may be known as the cause of the universe, but he's saying that there's a cause beyond him. Brahma is saying that he's just one of the effects coming from the supreme cause. Therefore, it's best for me to surrender unto his feet. Now, let's talk about that word surrender. If you look in the dictionary, what will be the definitions of the word surrender? It sounds very intimidating. It sounds very restricting. Not simply if you're born in the West, but also if you're recently born in India, surrender. It sounds like you were walking in the wrong part of Melbourne at night and some criminals, they approach you and say, okay, surrender your wallet, surrender your purse. So we get that kind of reaction when we hear about surrendering to Krishna. I have to give up something that belongs to me, something that's dear to me. Krishna's forcibly demanding this. Indeed, the dictionary definition of surrender is that you stop resisting to an enemy. You're dealing with an enemy and you realize you're outgunned. So you stop fighting, you stop resisting. Okay, enemy, I surrender. So that attitude is often how we subconsciously deal with Krishna's presentation in Bhagavad Gita. Sarva dharmam prichaja mame kam shadanam vaja. Abandon all varieties of your ideas, your plans, your thoughts of what is dharma, and just surrender to me. You feel like you're being held up, mugged. I have to cease resistance to the enemy because I'm overpowered. Number one, cease resistance to the enemy. And then number two, submit to subordination to the enemy. So we have those traces when we are dealing with Krishna's offer. Surrender to me. Another definition of surrender, dictionary definition, is that you give something away, generally by force upon demand. Surrender this. I don't want to, but I have to. Okay. So just think in your mind how all these different tinges influence your hearing of Krishna's offer when he says, surrender to me. Okay, I'm going to be forced to give up something that's dear to me. Another definition of the word surrender is to totally submit to a certain emotion or mood, to surrender to anger, to surrender to jealousy, to surrender to lust. Where do we find a positive definition of surrender? You only find that in Bhagavad Gita. You learn how Krishna is worth surrendering to. The surrender to Krishna is like a little child accepting the dominance of the loving mother. When you look at a little child, you're seeing surrender in relation to the mother. I've seen mothers with newborn infants. They walk around the house holding the infant, and the infant is surrendering. And the mother is trying to give all protection. What can the little child, 6 months old or whatever, what can the child do? But is the child forced to surrender? In one sense, by the arrangement of material nature, the child is forced to take birth in a certain womb, forced to have certain parents. But from another angle, the child is relishing the surrender. Have you ever thought to ask a little infant, do you have a problem resting on the lap of your mother? Do you have some hang-up about it? No. It's a natural fit for the baby. Similarly, Krishna is pointing out, it's a natural fit for you, his part, to surrender to him. The surrender is not forced. You know, at the end of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, yatechasi tata kuru. I've told you everything. Think about it and do what you want to do. So the surrender is not forced. But Krishna is trying to convince us that it's 100% in our best interest, especially since it is our constitutional nature. Just like, relatively speaking, it is the constitutional nature of the infant to be dependent on the mother. How many of you would bust into a scene of a mother nursing her child or changing her child's nappies and cry out to the child, "Stop, stop, you're being exploited, fight back, resist, don't be so accepting"? You would never do that. You know, the child has a loving mother. It's the constitutional nature of the baby to depend fully on the mother. So Krishna is making the same presentation. And Brahma is certifying that this is what I do. Brahma is saying that he surrenders unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And now he's describing the benefits. Bhavachchidam swasjayanam sumangalam. Benefit number one. Everyone likes to hear about benefits, right? When you get an insurance policy, whether travel insurance or private health insurance, you're always looking, what are the benefits? When you evaluate government leaders, often you want to consider, what benefits are they giving? So benefits are very important. And Bhagavatam describes the benefits of surrender to Krishna. Bhavachidam, number one. Benefit. The repetition of birth and death stops. How valuable is that to you? Now just feel the ignorance rise up in your consciousness. Well, so what about birth and death? So what if it goes on? It may happen, it may not happen. Who knows if there's a cycle of birth and death? But right now there are important things to worry about. Finances. Getting a bigger house. Shall I rent or shall I mortgage? Is it the right time for how are the mortgage rates doing? How will my marriage be arranged? When will it happen? Is it the best time now? So many so-called important considerations are dominating our intelligence. Therefore, when we hear about stopping the cycle of birth and death, it sounds so kind of hazy, doesn't it? Cycle of birth and death, stopping it. Even you're coming from India, in which you have some knowledge of that there is samsara, repeated birth and death. Still, it sounds like such a distant concept. It's not impending. This is because people are ignorant. Even you talk about climate change to them, and that sounds, pretty hot yesterday, but you know, I guess these things just happen. Now in New Zealand, in the Auckland area at least, it's warmer in the winter than Melbourne. So people thought that's very good, but then because of the warm winter, the mosquito eggs weren't killed, and so spring, summer comes, and heaps of mosquitoes. So people think, well, I wonder why is that? Anyway, so many mosquitoes, no problem. Gets buy more spray. Thank God for science. You never get to the root issue. Environmental leaders are wondering, what will it take to wake people up to accept that there is climate change? What are we going to do? Politicians are in denial. The people don't want to think about it. What's the best way? Should we present a doomsday scenario? Or should we present that there's still room to act? There's still hope. You can still avoid it. Time is almost running out. How to deal with this? So you see that people can't even accept material, the potential for material upsets. What to speak of repeated birth and death? Samsara? It's a very interesting concept. A concept that should be discussed in philosophy classes, in theology classes. But that you're meant to feel the need to become free from samsara as a basic instinct in your life? Oh, no. So Brahma is describing that as benefit number one. Bhavachidam. Surrendering to the lotus feet of Krishna stops the repetition of birth and death. This is the topmost human concern before you get to the transcendental level. What am I going to do about this cycle of birth and death? Parents are instructed by Srimad Bhagavatam, don't have children. Teachers are instructed by Bhagavatam, don't have students. Anyone in any responsible position is instructed, don't take it up unless you can guarantee that you can rescue your dependent from the cycle of repeated birth and death. So what are you all going to do now? Go ask your parents. I wonder, when you were planning your family, did you consider whether you were going to be able to stop your children's repeated birth and death? You ever thought to ask your parents that? It's just not a consideration. But in real human life, it is a foremost consideration. That's why Rishabhdev in the fifth canto of Bhagavatam makes that instruction. In a real human civilization, this is the concern of the parents. This is the concern of anyone in some kind of position of responsibility for others. So we can evaluate ourselves. How much we feel this pressing need to stop the cycle of repeated birth and death. Remember when Vishwamrita Muni came to see Maharaj Dasarath in Ram Lila, because Vishwamrita Muni wanted to recruit Ram for killing demons. And he approached Maharaj Dasarath, the king, and the king inquired of Vishwamrita Muni according to his occupation. Vishwamrita Muni, although born a Kshatriya, was acting and with the qualities of a Brahmana. So how did Dasarath Maharaj approach him or respond to his presence, Vishwamrita Muni's coming to the palace? He asked him, how are you progressing in your efforts to conquer repeated birth and death? That's your occupation, especially you're a Brahmana. So I'd like to know, how is the occupation progressing? Similarly, in the sixth canto of Bhagavatam, when Angira Rishi and another sage came to see Maharaj Chitraketu, they asked him, according to his varna, not how are you doing, but is everything under control? Because they're talking to a Kshatriya. Are you maintaining your citizens? Are the citizens happy? The question that Maharaj Dasarath asked Vishwamrita Muni actually applies to every intelligent human being, not just the Brahmanas. It simply especially applies to the Brahmanas because they're supposed to be dedicating their life to acquiring real knowledge and teaching real knowledge to others. So in this way, Dasarath Maharaj indicates the universal concern for everyone. How are we doing in our progress to conquer repeated birth and death? Now we go to benefit number two. Swasti ayanam, perception of all happiness. Your perception of happiness changes according to your level of advancement. When you are in material consciousness, your perception of happiness is completely mundane, based on the temporary, and always leads to frustration. As you become purified in bhakti, your perception of happiness changes. Board of today's verse, and I recommend everyone study it. Srila Prabhupada explains that there is no limit to spiritual happiness. Take the biggest thing that you ordinarily can imagine. That's the sky. The sky has a limit, but you can't see it. So you think the sky is great. But what is bigger than even the sky? Spiritual happiness. This is an example that really strikes home with us. Why should I be afraid of surrendering to Krishna when Krishna is offering something that's greater than the greatest thing I can see, which is the sky. Something with that is ever expanding, in fact. So we get a lesson in happiness through this purport. We hear that the ocean of material happiness is stagnant. You've ever seen a stagnant pond or a stagnant river, stagnant bathing kun, the scum on top that doesn't move? So that is the ocean of material happiness. It stays put. It doesn't increase. It doesn't move. It's the same old, same old. And therefore, the ocean of material happiness quickly becomes the ocean of frustration. But Anandam Buddhibardhanam, the ocean of spiritual happiness, Ananda is always increasing. In Srinivasacharya's prayers to the six Goswamis, Anandam Buddhibardhanaikanipano, what are the six Goswamis doing? They are always working to expand the limits of the ocean of transcendental bliss. That's their occupation. How can you say that they are just impractical, they're just mendicants, beggars? They're doing the greatest engineering work. They're always expanding the limits of the ocean of transcendental bliss by their Krishna conscious activities. In that way, they are the greatest benefactors for all living entities and are honored all over the three worlds, Srinivasacharya tells us. So we have that example of the sky as a comparison to spiritual happiness, in that spiritual happiness is greater than even the sky, which we can't measure. But then we get a spiritual understanding, using a spiritual dynamic to understand spiritual happiness. By nature, it's unlimited. That means that even Krishna himself cannot keep up with the limits of spiritual happiness. Even the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself can't measure spiritual happiness. So is that a defect? Is that a limitation? We thought the Supreme Personality of Godhead can do everything. Yet we find out that he can't measure spiritual happiness. So then, Prabhupada, in his ecstasy, in this purport, explains how, because the spiritual happiness is always increasing, it's coupled with the simultaneous increase of the Supreme Personality of God, his knowledge. The happiness increases, and then the Lord's knowledge of that increased happiness increases, and the two are always going on with eternal competition. Of course, there's no time in the spiritual world, but just for the sake of our understanding, we say like that. First, the happiness increases, and Krishna doesn't know. Then his knowledge increases about that increased happiness, and then he knows. But then the happiness increases, and then Krishna knows more. This is all time. Step one, step two, step three. But there's no influence of time in the spiritual world. But it's presented like this just so we can get a glimpse. This is what we are afraid of for surrendering to Krishna. This is what makes us hesitant. Of course not, if we actually know the benefits. Again, just like when you get an insurance policy, you have to know the benefits. If you're a sharp householder, you're always comparing insurance policies, or you go to websites that compare the policies. Am I getting the best benefits for my payments? So Brahma is saying, okay, let's look at the benefits of surrendering to Krishna. Swasti ayanam. You'll see the ocean of unlimited spiritual happiness, the sukha sindhu. Not the material sukha sindhu, but the spiritual sukha sindhu. You'll see how it's always increasing. So why not, in other words, why not take Krishna's offer? And then at the end of this ecstatic purport, you get a brief mention of a confidential subject matter discussed in the fourth chapter of Adi Lila Chaitanya Charitamrita. Kaviraj Goswami has very nicely described this dynamic increment of the ocean of spiritual happiness in the transcendental person of Srimati Radharani, the pleasure potency of Lord Krishna. So if you have read the fourth chapter of Adi Lila of Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, you'll find that Krishna can't keep up with the love of his dearest devotee. It's beyond him. And Krishna is sure that although he's tasting inconceivably unlimited pleasure because of her love, Krishna is sure she's tasting more. He can't keep up with the happiness that his dearest devotee is experiencing in relation to him. Krishna admits, it's beyond me. I can't measure it. Again, is there something that Krishna can't do? He says, as Krishna, I can't measure or calculate the happiness that she's feeling. But I will take on her emotions. I will take on the Radha Bhava. And so much so that my dark complexion becomes covered. And I will appear in a yellowish golden form as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In that way, I will experience what my dearest devotee is experiencing. Otherwise, as Krishna, I can't know it. I can't calculate it. But I am Krishna. So one of my possibilities is to appear as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Then I can understand. This is why understanding Lord Chaitanya is so crucial for bhakti. Without Lord Chaitanya, you cannot properly understand Krishna, because Krishna is never alone. The potent is always with his potencies. So to understand the full picture of the Absolute Truth, you need Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It is a great mystery how the happiness of the gopis lies in Krishna seeing their beauty and taking pleasure from that. When the gopis see that Krishna is enlivened by seeing their beauty, they become even more beautiful. And when they become even more beautiful, Krishna becomes even more enlivened. And when they see Krishna is even more enlivened, they become even more beautiful. And this way just goes on and on and on. That is the dynamic ocean of spiritual happiness. Krishna says, I can't measure it. What are they feeling? What are they tasting in relation to me? I can't calculate it. So this competition goes on and on eternally. That is the nature of Krishna's most intimate loving affairs. Kaviraj Goswami very scientifically explains that the lifestyle of Krishna's consorts seems to be selfish. They just want Krishna's love. It seems like that. They'll do anything to be with Krishna. It seems that way to the inexperienced vision, but actually, they know what to do to give Krishna pleasure. Even when they fight with Krishna and argue with him, they know it's 100% for his pleasure. So this is why we need so much preliminary and intermediate knowledge before approaching Krishna's loving affairs. Otherwise, we'll have that tendency to think, oh, I know what that's like. I can recognize it. When Krishna's consorts are dressing, combing their hair, it's all about they want to feel they look good. They want to feel that they're prestigious. It's all for their false ego. No, it's 100% for Krishna's pleasure. So much so that Chaitanya Charitamrita explains there's not the slightest, tiniest desire of Krishna's consorts for their own happiness. Not even one drop. They don't want it. They're not thinking about it. They're 100% thinking of Krishna's pleasure. But the paradox, as Srila Prabhupada explains in one purport, is that even though the gopis never think of their own pleasure to the slightest degree, not just try to get some glimpse of that, never think of your own pleasure to the slightest degree, come on, they must want something. Come on, there's got to be a pinch of selfishness there. It's inhuman. It's true, it's inhuman. You're dealing with Krishna's pleasure potency. So even though they don't want the slightest bit of happiness for themselves, what does Krishna do? He forces happiness on them. So that's what's going on in the topmost portion of the spiritual world. That is the pinnacle of pure devotion. You might think they don't want any happiness for themselves, even a pinch. They never think about it even slightly. So what then? What? Void? Zero? No. Krishna forces unlimited happiness on them. So in this way, we can see the depths of what is in store for us by surrender to Krishna. The third benefit, Sumangalam, surrender to Krishna's lotus feet is all auspicious. All auspicious. This is described in Nectar of Devotion as one of the six characteristics of pure bhakti. All auspiciousness means not just auspicious for this person or that species or that planet, but auspicious for all living entities in all times and all places. Devotional service has that effect. Surrender to Krishna, which is devotional service, has that effect. So let us consider how much we may be under the influences of negative connotations of the word surrender. Remember, I give up my resistance to an enemy and I submit. Or I give in to the demands, the forceful demands of someone. This is what we may be thinking subconsciously when we hear Krishna's proposal. But actually, as we discuss, Krishna's proposal is just like a mother picking up her little infant on her lap, holding the little infant to her chest. The infant is not objecting. The infant thinks, this is life. This is what it should be. So this is what Krishna is offering to you. Take up your real life. This is the way life should be. Your dependency on me is your constitutional position. All right, we'll stop here. Any questions? Yes. You get to the state of surrender by associating with those who are devotees of Krishna. And then you begin to trust Krishna. Otherwise, you're a little fearful. What am I going to lose? What's Krishna trying to take from me? I've struggled so hard for so many lifetimes to get something. Surrender must mean giving it all up. So you're a little cautious and wary. Then you hear the benefits. Approach the state of surrender by associating with devotees. In their association, you become inspired to read up on surrender. What are the benefits? And who are we surrendering to anyway? What's so special about Krishna? You ever wondered that? What's so special about Krishna? Huh? But before you started coming here, what did you think? Huh? Of course, he's one of the whole panorama portfolio of gods. Yeah. So many gods. Did your family adopt what I call the broad coverage insurance policy? Worship all the gods. You might hit the right one by the, you know, the broad coverage. Give a little something to each god. Who knows? It's like the lottery. You might hit the one that actually does something. But you come here and you actually authoritatively understand Krishna. That's the beginning of your surrender. Well, that's why we have Srimad Bhagavatam. Yes. So you should study it. Other questions? Yes. To tell you the truth, on one hand, it is austere, sitting and hearing the praises of others. It is austere. But looked at from another point of view, it's done as a service. And devotional service to Krishna is blissful and wonderful. But from another point of view, it's austere. Even physically, it's austere. You know, the latest scientific research shows that sitting for long periods of time for human beings is bad for your health. It actually decreases your lifespan. That's why at all the progressive workplaces, they're getting stand-up desks and even desks that have treadmills that you stand at your desk and walk on a treadmill while you're doing your... Yes, it's happening. It hasn't hit Australia yet. Oh, yeah, a big thing in USA now. Just wait. 2 years from now, same thing in Australia. Because it's considered unhealthy to sit for long periods of time without moving. Without moving doesn't simply mean, you know, moving your fingers on the keyboard or doing like this. No, you actually have to get going, get up and get going. So many of our material life turn out to be inauspicious. What you think is so comfortable, well, sitting down for hours is nice. Turns out to be reducing your lifespan. This is the story of Kali Yuga. So, yes, it is a little physically difficult sitting, especially when persons are following the Shastra and offering homages to their spiritual master. But from another point of view, as we said, it is the parampara system. And so therefore, one takes up that role as a service. Yeah, one day I can tell you about all the austerities. You think it's nice being garlanded all the time? What about if you have allergies? Someone puts a garland of carnations on me, I'm finished.
I say, oh, look at Maharaj, she gets all those garlands.
Yeah, come ask me, I'll tell you what's going on. You know, I'm sneezing, my eyes are tearing up. And then the ultimate nectar from garlands, they stain your clothes. Oh no, this is the second kurta that's got rose petal stains on it, whatever. The ladies know which flowers stain clothes. Well, I hope they know anyway. Okay, my second kurta is full of garland stains. Oh no, I'm not going to Vrindavan or Mayapur for another 5 months. I'm out of clothes. What am I going to do? These are part of the occupational austerities. Just wanted to let you know that. And then they bring you all this prasad, you know. You might say, ooh, he's really enjoying. But, you know, I can only eat a tiny bit of it. Otherwise, you know, I'll get sick. Or won't be effective in my service. So they put all these, you know, preparations in front of you. But, you know, you just can't eat. You probably can't eat any of it. And they know it. They know there's going to be almost all of it for them. So they bring all the pizzas, all the lasagna, ice cream, this and that. here, Guru Maharaj. It's all your mercy, only for your pleasure. And they know you're just going to take a little peck, you know? So just think of the temptation, all this prasad spread out in front of you, and you have to eat for Krishna's pleasure. So these are some of the occupational austerities. I don't want to say occupational hazards. But you do it as a service to Krishna. Of course, the best reaction you see is written by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur in his essay about the austerity of accepting disciples. He's very graphic about it. Just look at me, a big brute sitting on this chair, and all these glorifying words are aimed at me. It's Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So, in conclusion, though, I'm very thankful to the devotees for the wonderful ceremony that they put together. And it was very moving, very inspiring. And so I feel obligated to try to increase my meager service to the devotees. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, is a fact that possible candidates for spiritual life can often be afraid of spiritual institutions. And so you actually have to give them examples, let them be part of a community that is caring, is loving, inspiring. You can begin to explain to such persons that it's not about like a cold mechanical institution. It's about being part of a loving community of bhakti yoga practitioners. That's the best way to start. And you can explain that ISKCON is like a hospital. Hospitals are for diseased persons. They're not for healthy persons. Just by someone admitting that they are diseased, that is an extraordinary step forward in Kali Yuga. As those of you who are doing outreach, book distribution, and other forms of cultivation, meeting people, you know, everyone thinks basically they're normal. I'm fine. I'm good. I'm fine. Everything's okay. So to actually admit that one needs a hospital is a great step forward. So ISKCON is like a hospital. And it's full of all different types of patients. You have the good patients, the so-so patients, and the rebellious patients. The portfolio of the hospital staff is to keep the place, keep the hospital sterilized in spite of so many outbreaks of germs. Hospitals expect germ outbreaks. And they have ways to deal with that. That's the service done by the hospital staff. Just like, you know, when His Holiness Indradumna Maharaj was having one surgical operation, everything seemed fine, and then it turned out that he picked up some infection in the hospital. So what are you going to do now? Ban all hospitals? Shut down all hospitals because... Not only Maharaj, but it's a fact. So many persons pick up infections in hospitals. But you accept implicitly that the overall benefit of a hospital is that you get better. You accept that. So therefore you tolerate any discrepancies. you tolerate their existence in that you don't freak out when you don't become capsized when you find, look what that devotee has done or was doing. Just like 2 days ago, one airplane that took off from Melbourne Airport immediately had to turn around and do an emergency landing. No problem. No one was hurt. You know, the fire brigade had raced out onto the runway to greet the airplane, and all the emergency workers were there. But evidently, as soon as the airplane took off, there was some engine problem. And so immediately the pilot landed it again. Now, do you see throughout Melbourne people saying, that does it, I'm not flying anymore? No, they don't think like that. No one thinks like that. None of you would think like that. What you would think is, well, the emergency was dealt with. That shows you I should fly even more. The brigade was there when the plane landed. The emergency workers were racing to the site. Everything was working like clockwork. You know, so that gives me faith. They dealt with the emergency. The pilot obviously was very skillful. He easily landed a plane with possible engine problems. So therefore, sometimes in the ISKCON hospital, there are problems. But you see, how are the problems dealt with? And don't be surprised that in a hospital there's an outbreak of germs, staph infection, whatever, different kinds of bacteria. Don't be astonished. But see how the doctors deal with it. It takes a while for new devotees to appreciate that sometimes patients in the hospital don't follow the doctor's orders and they cause a bit of a commotion. It takes a while. Because at first you're shocked. Why isn't every devotee perfect? Remember what it was like the first time you realized that someone can leave Krishna consciousness? I know for me it was a shock. I thought once you come, you never go. I was asking, I remember older devotees in the New York temple, my first year, 1973, first half a year, why did so-and-so leave? I was just incredulous. Initiated devotee, such and such Prabhu left? How is that possible? So they had to explain to me that we have our independence and it's up to us to use our independence properly or misuse it. So for a new person, it takes some time to understand that. But you see how the hospital is going on. So that gives you assurance. Just like when the plane made its emergency landing 2 days ago. You saw how the government agencies responded. You saw how the pilot responded. Said, okay, I'll keep flying. I'm even more trustworthy now. So it's not so much that the existence of some problems should discourage someone. No. You watch and see how the problems are dealt with. And as the years go by in ISKCON, we become more and more expert in dealing with all kinds of problems. The doctor staff becomes more and more experienced, more and more mature. You can contrast that to, let's say, 1975 or 76, when one very prominent, the most prominent leader in Australia, had some discrepancies, and one of the members of Srila Prabhupada's staff put the word out to everyone, and Prabhupada was very angry. Now you have made it impossible for him to come back and be rectified. You have smeared his name everywhere. So that was 1975. Now, in 2014, such situations, if they arise, are dealt with very discreetly, expertly, taking into account all the stakeholders, all the possible ramifications. You'll always have two different kinds of responses, basically. Those who say, smash him immediately, and others, no, be merciful, look at all the service he did. So the GBC has to combine both aspects, you know, discipline and yet at the same time mercy. It's not easy. Got all these influences, you know, pouring down upon you. He should be smashed. He should be drawn and quartered. He should be hung. He should be lynched. And others, no, anyone can make a mistake. Look at all the service he did. And I remember 1975. Problem started in 74. Leader of the New York Temple. In fact, one of the first main devotee to come to Australia to start ISKCON, to Hong Kong and Australia. So he had gone back to New York. He was head of the New York Temple, and he was having some big problems. So he left in a very inauspicious way, and all the Sankirtan devotees thought that he had taken a lot of money with him, and we were very angry, and how we were listening to this leader. Meanwhile, this leader was doing this and doing that. So he disappeared and showed up 6 months later when Prabhupada came to Los Angeles. And I was sitting right in front of Prabhupada, waiting for Prabhupada to focus on me, realizing that I'm the center of the universe. I was sitting right in front of Prabhupada. And it was 1975. So it was time for Prabhupada's Guru Puja to begin. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I saw this devotee appear. And this is the first time in 6 months that any of us had seen him. By that time, there were at least 30 devotees from the New York Temple in Los Angeles because the BBT had moved to LA. So this is the first time we saw him. And then, sitting in front of Prabhupada, I saw Prabhupada look at him with such love in his eyes. I was shocked. Wait a minute. Well, Prabhupada's not looking at me like that. Such love. Prabhupada could not forget the service he had done. A young man just going off, you know, alone to Australia with no visible support. Prabhupada couldn't forget that. So, all these different aspects the GBC has to combine in dealing with problems. You have to remember how much service the person did. Do you want to break that person? Is there a process of rectification? And how do you satisfy those who are, you know, very angry about it? So, this is what leaders have to deal with. This is what the hospital staff has to deal with. Temples have to deal with this. International leaders have to deal with these things in this kind. So, obviously, this is beyond the level of what a beginning aspiring devotee can accommodate. So, therefore, the first thing you do is create a loving community. And that's what people will notice first. I can be nurtured. I can be encouraged. I can be developed in this loving community of knowledgeable devotees. Then, the existence of that loving community gives them a chance to grow. Like, you don't explain to a 2-year-old infant about how the Australian government's working. By the way, my dear 2-year-old child, do you realize that in 20 years you're going to be paying taxes? Do you know what GST is? Let the child have its nice childhood, you know? There'll be a time for everything. The main thing you want to see that child has is a loving family, loving parents. So give that first. Give the loving community first. And then the person will feel nourished, encouraged, and safe. And then they can start to understand the whole structure of the hospital, the international hospital, the job of the doctors, the sterilization processes, how germs can break out and how they're dealt with. So that is my recommendation. Mataji, any questions? Yes.
Also, sometimes during the lecture, you were mentioning that one should not become a teacher or a father or mother.
Yes, that's making you aware of the seriousness of the responsibility. And it does happen that persons who at one point were very serious about making that guarantee, later they became weak. That's what happens. You know, the Vedic system for making promises is that even if the promise turns out to be inconvenient for you in a very dramatic way, you still keep it. That's what Dasarath Maharaj's other wife was telling him. You promised me on the battlefield when I nursed you back to health, you gave me a benediction. I said, not now, later. It's now later. And Dasarath Maharaj was hesitating, like, oh, this is worse than death. Banish Ram, he's supposed to be crowned king tomorrow. I can't imagine something so horrible. This is the end of the world. And she started chiding him. What kind of Kshatriya are you? You made a promise, you have to keep it. But what is the contemporary standard for promises? Whether it's initiation vows or marriage vows or whatever. Yeah, I know I promised, but that was 2 months ago. And everyone will nod their head. Yeah, yeah, you know, got to do the best you can, you know. It's the way the world is. We didn't make the world this way. So it is true that persons who never suspected or expected that they would become weak, they become weak. So we have to, as a mature community, know how to deal with that. You can't condone it, and you can't just annihilate the person. It's a very intricate process that requires maturity. And remember, as Srila Prabhupada stated about such a situation, he said, don't be surprised who leaves, be surprised who stays. I think that it may sound just like a witty statement, but actually there's great depths to it. Judge who's a real devotee by who's actually around. I remember one devotee who was one of the first devotees to go behind the Iron Curtain for preaching. And it was so dangerous. No one ever wanted to go with the preacher. You know, generally we went alone. Because actually that was Prabhupada's instruction. When one leading devotee presented to him, we can't find anyone to go with these communist country, you know, preachers. It's too dangerous. No one wants to do it. Yeah. And Prabhupada said, so you go alone. That's what we did. We went alone. So before Prabhupada made that proclamation, the devotee was saying to Prabhupada, I can't go on like this. I can't. I want to go with some big leader. Some big leader should accompany me. Some Maharati. Are there any big guns who will go with me to preach in Eastern Europe? What was Prabhupada's response? The devotee told me. Prabhupada told him, watch out for those big guns. So he knew he's on to it. He knew what was going on. But Prabhupada did the best he could with whatever Krishna sent him. Most of the present leaders of ISKCON, the Prabhupada disciples, never imagined that they would be in their present positions. We were always in awe of the big guns. Of course, a few of the big guns of the 70s, they're more than intact. But many rusted. So the present generation of Prabhupada's leaders, for the most part, never dreamed, I'm going to be a leader, I want to be a leader. We never thought like that. Never even expected it. Just went about doing our service. So similarly, amongst many of you here, you don't know what your future is going to be. I don't want to scare you, but you might say, me, never. I could never be a leader. I could never take responsibility for others. But it'll happen. Somehow or other, it'll fall into your lap. Even if you don't look for it, it'll still fall into your lap. I sometimes tell the story how it was in the 90s, and I was in Mayapur. And one of my godbrothers, His Holiness Shivaram Raj, comes up to me and says, "You know, year after year, you look so blissful. You ought to be a GBC. You're just looking too blissful. We got to do something about this." Then we'll see how blissful you'll be. So I didn't say anything. I thought, wasn't thinking of such things. And then I had a very vivid dream of Srila Prabhupada. And he knew how to get my attention. He was approaching me with a Bhagavatam in his hand, in both hands. And I was thinking, wow, this is more of Prabhupada's 10th canto. Wow. So he came to me and held out the Bhagavatam. And I went, and as soon as I went to grab it, he took it, stuck it behind his back and said, "GBC." He knew how to reel me in, you know? How to keep me on the hook. So, many of you here might, you know, you don't know what your future is in terms of the ever-expanding service of Lord Chaitanya. So be ready. All right, we have someone who began his Krishna conscious practice here in Melbourne and is currently serving at New Govardhan. And he came especially for initiation, but we're not doing any yagyas, any fires, until April or May. But he made this special trip, and his temple president, Ajita Prabhu, would like that he's initiated now. So you please clear this. You can move right here. Yes, you can sit right there. So he has room to pay his dandavats. You'll have to put your feet that way. We're going to call up Bhakta Theo. So you say you're going to come back in April or May for the yagya? Is it possible? All right. Okay. So many of you know Bhakta Theo, yes? So please give him your blessings as he makes this step forward. Some devotees choose to do this quickly, and Bhakta Theo took the scenic route, but effective in that. After mature deliberation and consideration, he's ready to make this step. What are the four rules? What to do every day? Your name is Charanaravinda Das. Charanaravinda, of course, means the lotus feet of Krishna and Krishna's devotee. Charanaravinda Das. Beautiful name for a very nice devotee. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.